Thank you very much. So it's a pleasure to be here, and I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present my result here. So we'll also speak about polaritons like the previous two speakers, but actually about a different setup, namely realized with Rydberg atoms. And the talk will be a little bit less focused on non-equilibriums, but more an introduction into Rydberg polaritons and how to describe them theoretically. So there are a lot of collaborators which are actually here, and I had a lot of discussions with them, so I would like to acknowledge all of them. In my research group, Christoph Jakimski, which was involved in part of the work which I present, is actually here at the conference, and please ask him also some questions if you're interested about it. Now, what is the setup I have in mind about interacting Rydberg slow light polaritons? So the main motivation is by the beautiful experiment in a group by Vladimir Vuletic and Misha Lukin, where the idea is you send in photons into a cold atomic cloud here. So the cloud are cold atoms, but they are not ultra cold, so they don't yet form a Bose-Einstein condensate, but they are close to the Bose-Einstein condensation temperature. So you send in the light inside the media, they form these polaritons. They interact very strongly with each other because these are Rydberg polaritons. And then there is the output correlations which are measured in the detection. So when I'm speaking about, yes, it's a non-equilibrium problem, that it's a driven system with send in photons, they undergo transformations and strong interactions, and the interaction is detected afterwards. Now let me introduce what are slow light polaritons. And so Rydberg slow light polaritons has two concepts. One is electromagnetic induced transparency. That means that the atoms inside the medium are in a very special setup. So the atoms are characterized by three levels. So we have the ground state of the atoms. We have an intermediate p state, which typically decays very fast by a gamma, very decay rate gamma. Here we probe on this transition, the probe field is near resonant. So this is essentially the red light which is shined in through the transition, but there's an additional laser which strongly couples the P level to its excited Rydberg state, which I will later mainly introduce. And the main idea of electromagnetic induced transparency is that once the probe photon comes inside the media, it doesn't essentially see the P level, and it doesn't hardly see the medium. It doesn't see the medium in that sense that if the coupling laser is present, the photons go through the medium without a phase distortion or absorption. And this is true because once the photons enter the medium, they become a superposition of being in a ground state and being in excited state, here the Rydberg state. And due to this superposition, you see that there is no intermediate P state, and therefore there are no spontaneous emission and decay rates to this intermediate P state. Where does the word slow come from? You see here that a lot of weight is actually in the Rydberg state. So you have to imagine that this superposition most of the time stays at an atom, but it's a coherent superposition of sometimes moving as a photon with light velocity, being absorbed in an atom, coherently emitted, and be transformed as a photon. And therefore, the photon only travels with a reduced velocity because most of the time it's actually inside the Rydberg state. And there, the word slow light comes about. And that means that if we send in photons into the media, there's two effects. So the wave packet which enters the medium is on one hand slowed down, and on the second hand it's compressed. So the first part gets first slowed down, therefore the later part has time to catch up, and therefore the full wave packet is compressed. And that means even wave packets which outside the medium are longer than a kilometer nicely fits into a cold atomic gas cloud of the order of a few micrometers. And records in slowing down light goes that one slows down the light velocity up to 1 meter per second. And if we would like, one can even store the photons completely. So this is very known physics for a long time. The main motivation now comes apart that we can engineer an interactions between the photons by using a Rydberg state. So the idea which I would evoke here is that the slow light polaritons have a large contribution and probability to be in a Rydberg state, but Rydberg atoms are strongly interacting with each other. And that transfers a strong interaction onto the slow light polaritons. So what are Rydberg atoms? That's just like the hydrogen atom excited to a high main principle quantum number n. Here we have rubidium atom, so we choose an electronic state with a very high main principle quantum number n. Then it's known that the van der Waals interaction scales with the main principle quantum number n in power of 11, and we can understand that van der Waals is second order perturbation theory on dipole-dipole interaction. The dipole interaction scales with the distance from the core, that scales with n squared, so that's an n in power of 8, and it's an energy difference which we have to divide by in second order perturbation theory, and that's for hydrogen atom 1 over n squared, the energy difference is 1 over n cubed, and therefore one gets a scaling n into the power of 11. And that means van der Waals interaction extends to the range of several micrometers. And so these photons are interacting on a range of several micrometers. And the main phenomena which has seen a lot in Rydberg physics is a so-called blockade phenomena. So if we excite a Rydberg atom, if you have two Rydberg atoms which we would like to excite, and there's an interparticle distance, on large distances we can excite both atoms into the Rydberg state. But on short distances, as soon as one atom is in the Rydberg state, the excitation of the second atom into the Rydberg state is blockaded due to the interaction between the regime. And this defines as a typical length scale, which is given by the Rabi frequency with which we drive the system into the excited state, divided by the C6 coefficient in power 1 over 6. And this blockade radius for typical experiments is of the order of 5 micrometers. Now, these ideas have attracted a lot of interest in the past, and there is a rather incomplete overview of all the references, theory. So first, work was done by Fleischhauer, Kuritsky, Friedler, and a lot of work by the Harvard group, and also a lot of experiments going on and working in these regimes. Now, what has been observed, going back to the experiment? So this is, again, the MIT group. So one sends in the slow light, the photons, they are converted into slow light polaritons. It turns out the interaction is actually attractive, and they form a bound state. I will explain that more in detail when we come to the theory part. But what happens is that, indeed, once the photons leave the medium, there's a very strong bunching at short distances with a length scale determined by the bound state of the photons. So inside the medium, two photons form a bound state, and therefore they exit the medium with a preferred position on top of each other. And there's an antibunching close by, because if the photons are not a bound state, there's a quantum diffusion, and therefore it leads to a depletion of the particles just around where they are bound together by the bound state. And it's just very nicely demonstrated experimentally and with excellent agreement by the Harvard group. And this leads me a little bit to come to now the theory part. How do we actually describe this system? And I would like today essentially provide you a method how we can start to describe the many-body physics. So far we know that we are in the regimes where there is a very, very strong interactions between two photons, and we can hope to go into the regime of strong many-body physics with these systems. But we need a proper theory and understanding how we describe these systems. So I will start with the microscopic theory and show you how we can derive the two-body bound state properties and scattering states. Then I would like to demonstrate that actually higher body interactions in this system can also be derived, but they are not weak. So there are very, very strong higher body interactions present. And then I will come to applications that one can not only look at this 1D propagating setup, but extend it also into higher dimensions. So what is the microscopic descriptions of the system? We have the photons, which are described by the field operator psi e. They have the slow light velocity, they have the light velocity, and therefore are propagating in one direction. Then we don't describe the atoms separately, but we describe them as a continuous field. So there's a large cloud, and because there are so many atoms, we can assume that at every position in space where we want one, there is an atom sitting. And this is true as long as the photon density is much smaller than the atomic density. And therefore, we have a field operator which just creates out of this state at some position a reciprocal intermediate state P. So that's the field operator psi P that creates an atom in an intermediate state P, and psi S creates a reciprocal atoms at position X. So psi, the jet lag is slowly kicking in, so please excuse for that. So psi S creates reciprocal position atoms at position X. I neglect kinetic energy of my atoms because the experiment is much faster than the kinetic energy of my atoms, and therefore we consider it in a frozen regime where during the experiment all atoms are frozen in space, and only after the photons have left the sample again we can consider them slowly moving around. So we don't have to worry about the kinetic energy of the atoms, and therefore we also don't have to worry about the statistics of the atoms. And therefore, everything are bosonic fields in this sample. Now the approximations also, we have the standard rotating, we move to the rotating frame and have rotating wave approximations. And in addition, we consider as a chiral fields, so there's no backscattering. This approximation is extremely excellent because once the photon is moving inwards, it essentially makes a W state like excitations, where the phase of the photon is imprinted into the atomic excitation. In order to scatter backward, we must provide this momentum of the photon to make a backward scattering. But as long as the atomic density is smooth on the length scale of the photon, there is no backscattering possible. So in that sense, it's really a chiral system that the photons cannot backscatter. They can just, via spontaneous emission from the intermediate P level, scatter in all different positions in space. And note also here that I drop the spontaneous emission rate from the reciprocal level because we again assume that the experiment is done faster than the decay from a reciprocal level happens. And for simplicity, we have the decay from the intermediate P levels, which we should describe by master equation, but as long as we are just looking at the fixed number of photons, we can include it by imaginary decay rate or an imaginary detuning from the P level. Yes?
Are you really just considering a one-dimensional system?
In total, we have a transverse wave function, which is the focus of the laser beam, but we are interested where the blockage radius is much larger than the transverse size of the photon, and then it reduces to a completely one-dimensional system. So in theory, it's a focused laser beam, but we don't have to worry about scattering out of this focus. That is everything essentially just scattering in all of the space. Now, how does this Hamiltonian describe slow light polaritons? So we can immediately diagonalize the Hamiltonian. Then one gets three branches. And a nice picture is to think of it. So we have the reciprocal state in rotating frame is at zero energy. We have the P level, which is detuned by its finite detuning here. And we have the fast slow light coupling. But once we turn on the coupling strength G, there's adiabatic avoided crossings opening. And therefore, we have a slow light polariton with a very flat dispersion relation, indicating that they are indeed slow light polaritons, and we get two branches of an upper bright polariton and a lower bright polariton, while down here they are just uncoupled photons. And so we get the dispersion relations for the slow light polaritons, which in leading order is linear with a slow light velocity determined by the coupling parameters, and there is a correction to it which gives an effective mass for our slow light polariton. And notice that slow light means that omega squared is smaller than g squared, and orders of magnitudes in experiment are that g squared is of the order of 10 gigahertz, while omega squared is of the order of 10 megahertz. So there is three orders of magnitude difference which can be achieved experimentally. And then it's straightforward to include the interactions between reciprocal atoms. So now, in this many-body field theory, we just have the field operators for the reciprocal states and the strong van der Waals interaction. And it's important that we cannot treat the van der Waals interactions as a perturbation due to its divergence on short distances. So we really have to include the full van der Waals interaction for our microscopic analysis. And there are a few discrepancies to normal quantum field theories in condensed matter physics. So first, we break Galilei invariance because we have atoms at rest and moving photons, but energy momentums are still conserved. But otherwise, we could view it as free bosonic field with a quartic interaction. I integrated out the transverse degrees of freedom. So yes. Oh. Was it? Yes, so our fields are in a certain transverse mode, which is given by the laser field, and we just integrate the effective interaction over these transverse fields. Yes, but it's shorter than the blockade. Yes, but it's shorter than the blockade radius. So, yeah. As cut off, okay, 2D integration of r over r to the 6 doesn't give us something finite. So it's modified on short distances, but still diverging. And then the goal is, therefore, we are interested in slow light polaritons. So let's get rid of the bright states and derive an effective field theory for the slow light polaritons alone. And the idea is just like in cold atomic gases, we know that the scattering between cold atoms is purely described by an effective S-wave scattering length. So let's derive the exact scattering properties of the system, including integrating out all these virtual excited bright polariton states. And the simplest approach to achieve that is actually trying to calculate the T matrix exactly. So the idea is, let's calculate the T matrix for two polaritons alone, so we don't have to worry about loop diagrams. It's purely a sum of ladder diagrams, but we include that all virtual states are these virtual excitations of bright polaritons and also dark polaritons. So that means that we can write down the T matrix in a Lippmann-Schwinger equation. So we have the T matrix is the van der Waals interaction. Then we have the van der Waals interactions, the two-particle propagator, chi, and again the T matrix. And that means that the two-particle propagator is the sum of all potential virtual states which we can generate. And then there is an overlap, which is always the amplitude of this state to be in a Rydberg state. So these are these horrible overlap functions. Now one can look at this horrible expression for a very long time, but yeah, and it took us a very long time to realize that it has a very simple form. So the two-particle propagator can be very nicely written. It's essentially a constant part and a combination of two poles. The first pole is just the effective mass, which I have introduced before, and describes massive particles moving in this moving frame with the slow light velocity. There is a second pole, which we can understand that because the slow light polaritons can be excited into a lower state and a higher state, so there is a resonance conditions of momentum and energy where this process can happen. And so that is the process that you send in two slow light polaritons, but it can split up into an upper bright and a lower bright, which is resonant in energy and momentum. And this is exactly the second pole which appears here. And then there is just the constant saturations, which describes that at a high momenta, these polariton branches just saturate. And that means we can rederive now our Lippmann-Schwinger equations. So we can get rid of the effective, we can get rid of the constant part by introducing an effective interaction potential. So the T matrix equation in this form is exactly equivalent by introducing an effective interaction potential where we get rid of this constant part, and the effective interaction potential is the van der Waals interaction, 1 minus this constant saturation part times the van der Waals interaction. And this describes us exactly what we expected. At large distances, our polaritons interact via van der Waals interaction. But at short distances, it saturates because only one excitation is excited onto the Rydberg state, and the other one remains actually a photon part. So that means we got rid of this divergence in a van der Waals interaction and have now a very simple form with two poles. And the nice form is also that the second pole is actually extremely tiny. So this resonance scattering into brighter states is exponentially suppressed once one focuses on low energies and low momenta. Yeah? M is the mass of the polaritons. So it's the, okay, on one hand, this is the exact two-particle propagation. The mass is the same as if you expand the single polariton dispersion relations into slow light and a mass term. Then this mass term already appears. But in that shape, it's actually the exact shape. Okay, you can always shift everything from omega bar and alpha and just introduce here a scale which you want. But this is really the mass which appears in the equation. And the slow light drops out because they are moving in parallel. So in relative coordinates, the slow light velocity doesn't matter. And so, happily, the second pole doesn't play a role in a lot of parameters, and especially in a parameter regime where the experiments are interested, namely at slow energies and low momenta, or in another regime which is the far detuned, where the detuning is much larger than the Rabi frequency of the blue laser beam. And that tells us that the equation for two polaritons is just a simple Schrödinger equation with an effective interaction potential and for massive particles. And we can solve it numerically or analytically. And it tells us that indeed we have in low momentum, we can describe the scattering by just a 1D scattering length. And there are two parameter regimes. So there is an attractive regime where we get, so for attractive interactions, the scattering length in 1D is positive. And whenever there is a zero crossing or a crossover, a crossing to infinity, which means that the new bound states appears into the attractive potential, indicating the analog of a Feshbach resonance. And this parameter can be tuned by the tunings of, for example, of our polaritons or by the blue coupling laser. So here we can tune the analog of Feshbach resonances by just tuning our external parameters, while if we are in a repulsive branch, if you have a repulsive interactions, the 1D scattering length starts at minus infinity, there's a zero crossing, and then just continuously grows. Yes? Ah, okay. I dropped my parameters. Yes, so I plot them repulsive, but I didn't tell you what it is. So if you go back, so there, on one hand, you have to tune the chi properly such that the chi doesn't have this singularity. There's also interesting physics when there is not just such a nice shape, but there is actually a resonance feature appearing. I won't focus on that. But the effective, whether the interaction is positive or negative, depends also on the mass. And the mass sign of the mass depends on the detuning. So that means that it's not only dependent what is the sign of the effective interaction, it's especially also important what is the sign of the mass. And the both of these quantities are actually not independent of each other. So they are related by the parameters. And therefore, so to give you all the parameters in details, we should discuss afterwards. But in short, it is once you're in a far detuned regime, omega smaller than the detuning, delta, then the interaction is always attractive. You cannot tune it around. So the two parameters tell you it's always an attractive interaction. If omega is much larger than the detuning, you can make a transition to repulsive interaction. And so this is where omega is smaller than delta, omega is larger than delta, and this is the regime where omega is smaller than delta. And therefore here, now just in a far detuned regime, we don't have to restrict it to low momenta, but then one can nicely plot all the bound state physics which appears. So remember, because it's not Galilei invariant, the energy dispersion strongly depends on the center of mass motion. So that means the red line is the is the propagation of two polaritons at zero relative momenta, lower threshold, but changing the center of mass. Now, traditionally, this is just a straight line, but because here we have no Galilei invariance, it actually strongly depends. And therefore, the bound state energy is not independent on the center of mass, but actually changes with changing center of mass momenta. And the same, once we increase the interactions, there are several bound states appearing which one can probe experimentally. And therefore, if you want to combine everything together, then the effective many-body theory, which one derives from it, is now at low energies. We have this low light velocity. We know there is an effective mass appearing in the problem. So this is the kinetic energy. We have our effective interactions, which includes the saturation at short distances. And we know that this is valid in a low momentum regime and in regimes where the photonic density is lower than the blockade radius appearing, where the probability to have three photons on the same site is much lower than, is strongly suppressed compared to the probability to have photons far away from each other. And because we can tune actually this scattering length, this is a very ideal system to explore the transition from the Lieb-Linegar model for A1D, so repulsive interactions, to actually attractive one by just tuning the parameters through a Feshbach resonance type physics. But then there is an important question: what happens actually with these dots here? I neglected completely interactions which can appear between free particles, and the question is, can this be important? Now, before I focus on that part, just one short comment: can we also probe this physics? And the answer is yes, there is a parameter regime where the mass term doesn't play a role. So then we can drop the mass term, and then we get a very simple Hamiltonian for our system, where we can vary the density of the atomic cloud, and it's completely solvable for arbitrary atomic density and arbitrary incoming and outgoing fields. So as soon as the mass drops out, is an exact solvable theory for arbitrary two-body and many-body interactions. And from the solution, so here's, for example, shown a solution for two photons, one immediately finds that the photons pick up a phase shift which encodes the effective interaction potential. So by measuring the phase shift in this parameter regime by a homodyne detection, one can experimentally has access really to get microscopically to these effective interaction potentials. And if one wants to measure higher body interaction, one just have to increase the homodyne detections, not only measure correlations in homodyne, but actually measure free-body correlations in homodyne detections, which then will reveal actually potential higher-body interactions. But how important are these many-body interactions? Is there an estimation which we can make to understand whether we can neglect them or whether we have to include them? And there's a simple approach to actually estimate them. So our wave function for n photons is a superposition of being in a ground state and Rydberg states. But we know due to the blockade physics, there cannot be two Rydberg excitations on short distances. So let's assume, look at the position where the many-body wave function all are at the same position. Then it tells us we have a probability or the weight of the number the probability to have one Rydberg atoms and n minus one photons. So that's the weight in this wave function, which is n times because we don't know which photon is in a Rydberg state. And then we have g squared over g squared plus omega squared once. That's the probability to be in a Rydberg state. And the other photons are in a photonic state. That's omega 2 n minus 1. So this is the probability that we have one Rydberg and n photons. In these situations, the photons acquire Aes's dark shift because now they see the P level actually. They are no longer on EIT resonance because the Rydberg state blocks the EIT phenomena. and therefore all other photons acquire an AC Stark shift. The AC Stark shift is minus h plus g squared over delta, and therefore they acquire a total dispersive energy shift, just the product of these two phenomena. Now inserting it, it gives immediately the correct saturations of the two-body interaction, and once one calculates it for free particles, subtracts the part for freed photons on the same side, one finds the effective free-body interaction, which for g going to very large to omega actually becomes of the same order as the two-body interaction. So that tells us that free-body interactions cannot be neglected for slow light polaritons. They are extremely strong and of the same strength as actually the two-body interactions.
Question?
Yes? Somewhere I missed. Ah, here is dispersive energy shift for one photon, but you have n minus one photons. So that's the product times n minus one gives this factor times h plus g squared and the probability above. Yeah. So the derivation, we choose a different approach than a diagrammatic one, and so let's just get another look at the two-body interaction potential, how we can also understand it. Let's focus now, instead of propagation, on a cavity. The atomic cloud is in the center, and so we have just one photonic mode for the photon. The effective interaction is just determined by the energy shift if we put two photons into the cavity, integrated over the positions of our polaritons. So this is how interactions are defined. It's our energy shift of the density of the particle, where the particle is, times our effective interaction. Now this set of equations is much simpler because we don't have to worry about the propagations of the photons, and therefore we could get coupled free equations. Solving these equations gives us exactly our effective interaction potential back. So let's do this approach for free particles in the cavity. Then we get an energy shift for three photons in the cavity, which you can split off into the sum of the two particle interactions plus the remaining free body interaction. The equations are now a complete nightmare. So in simplest way, one just still ends up with four coupled equations where the solution is no longer so trivial. But after a few analytics, which I'm happy to explain after my talk, one arrives at an analytical expression for the effective interaction. And it corresponds in several approximations or several limits with what one expects. So again, it saturates exactly our expectation from our naive estimations before. So the saturations, the blockade becomes exact. It has the alpha cubed limit, so it produces the correct saturation, the correct dependence if we reduce the probability for Rydberg states in a Rydberg state. And it has a correct cancellation at larger distances. So switching to Jacobi coordinates, we can illustrate the free-body interaction. So this is a pure free-body interactions in unit of the blockade radius. You see the nice six-fold symmetry, which is always present in Jacobi coordinates. You see that on one hand, it's now repulsive. So now you have a good point. So my two-body contributions I plot here now in a correct unit such that it is attractive. Therefore, the free body interaction changes sign and it removes the dip in the center and essentially tells us that free photons on very short distances are essentially non-interacting, while the branches here are just the interactions at larger distances. So then one can ask, does it actually remove the bound state? So because now we have increased the interaction, so it's strongly repulsive, is there still a bound state possible? But physics tells us that in 2D, as long as there is some attractive part of the potential, there is still a bound state present. And this is indeed what we find by solving it. So this is the bound state energy if we don't have any free body interaction present. So if we just drop it, this is the strength of the interaction. For weak interactions, we can replace the interaction by a delta function. So then it's the famous Lieb-Linegger solution. And the free body bound state in Lieb-Linegger is just 4 times the bound state energy of the two-body bound state. So the free-body bound state is a factor 4 times the two-body bound state. And that's essentially this curve here. Once we increase the interactions, we nicely get to the value 4. If we have a finite slow light velocity, so if we increase omega over g squared, then we are still very close to this behavior. But in a regime of slow light, one actually sees very nicely in the bound state solution the repulsive part on short distances by a depletion of the free body bound state. And this has also immediate consequences for transmission through this system. So if one looks at correlation functions now in the transmitted light, then instead of the nice peak by experimentally indicating the two-body bound state, this is the free-body correlation functions minus all the connected free-body correlation functions, so removed all the two-body part. Then there is the free-body bound state appearing. So this is a solution without the free-body interactions. And indeed, once one adds the free-body interactions, one clearly sees the broadening of the shape and the strong reduction in the center. And as the chairman is already standing, very shortly, so there are ideas now. I told you that we can go to a single mode cavity, but the interesting physics will appear if we allow 2D physics. And this can be achieved by a multimode cavity, where there are actually many degenerate modes in a cavity present, which allows now for the kinetic energy of the system. And let me just skip that. And please ask me about the multimode cavity afterwards. And thank you for your attention.
Do I understand correctly that so the effect of three-body interaction is just to make sure that when three atoms, for whatever you have there, close to each other, just switches off interaction? So they're not independent. Three-body and two-body are not independent. Can you have no two-body interaction and only three-body interaction?
Not yet. I would love that to do. So that, yeah, so the question is, for example, if we now move to the point where we have a Fischbach resonance, or where we just are the crossing of two states, where the S-wave scattering vanishes, then we actually would expect that the free body starts to dominate. So in that sense, the question is, yes, can we go to the regime where there is just a zero crossing of the S-wave scattering, the analog of the 1D scattering length, and then the free body will still be present, and that would be the situations where we have pure free-body interaction. Another idea is just using different dressing fields, that instead of having one Rydberg state, you also have a coupling of a second Rydberg state with a different van der Waals coefficient, which gives you two different two-body interactions, such that one cancels, and the strength of the free-body remains the same. What we can tune is, so maybe I was too quick about that part. They are not completely independent because we have the alpha. And the alpha is the probability to be in a Rydberg state. So two-body interaction scales with alpha squared, and free-body scales with alpha cubed. Now for slow light, alpha is nearly 1. So for slow light, it's very difficult to tune it. But if one reduces and makes the photons just faster, yes, you can do the regime. You can reduce the free-body interaction. So there is a tiny control parameter.
This graph is going to zero, right? I don't know what the horizontal axis is, but.
So, horizontal axis is essentially the blockage radius divided, you can call it the wavelength of the photons given by the mass. And it characterizes the strength of the interaction. So, this direction increases the effective depth of the potential. So, no. The resonance here is the point where new bound state appears into the system. Like for S-wave scattering in three dimensions, the zero crossing just happens at some point in between, where the one bound state which you have cancels the contributions of this second state, which is coming down. That would be the guess, yes. Yeah, that is the hope that we can achieve, yes. And that's also for the, yeah, yes.
We have time for a few more questions.
So this is just something I guess I get confused by. In these systems, which are, I guess you're loading into dark states essentially, how do you actually push the photons into a three-photon bound state or a two-photon bound state?
So in the end, it's now we come to the non-equilibrium part. Yes, I mostly talked about equilibrium. So there are two approaches. One is you send in photons at a certain energy, at zero energy. Then you have to decompose these incoming photon wave functions into all eigenstates inside the system. And because there is a bound state, it gets a weight. The incoming wave function has a weight to be in a bound state. And it has the superposition of all other states. Then it propagates through the medium. And towards these propagations, it picks up a phase, accumulates a phase, depending on the energy of the different states. And therefore, you get the interference and the bound state peak in the end. So you don't have, I think Alex expresses it much nicer, because you have the slow light velocity, it's a derivative in space. Now we got rid of the derivative in time because we are fixed frequency, but propagation suddenly plays essentially the role of time in the system. So it's like you decompose your incoming wave functions by propagating in space. They pick up a phase depending on the state they are in, and the outgoing light then has the interference of that. So it's this, if you for the two photon, it's the same. You start with a wave function which is one everywhere, to decompose it into a delta function contributions, evolve it in time, and look at the picture after a certain time. And then you see that the bound state clearly appears as a delta function because the photons kind of move apart from each other, while all the other states, due to the massive part, disperse outward. And that's the same for the free body. I didn't tell you the units. So you see this is the free body correlation. The free body correlations are fixed to zero. So green is the zero value. So you get the bunching at short distances. Then you get the anti-bunching because everything moves away. And then you see what it increases again. So that means asymptotically everything goes to zero. And how far it increases again depends how long the medium is. While the shape of the bound state, the sharpness of this peak, remains independent on the length of the medium.
Question. So can you tune your interactions such that these guys become fermions? If this, you know, sort of change the statistics of these polaritons?
Okay, so in...
Can you basically go between the statistics, different statistics?
The answer is no. So these are really... Both the photons are bosonic degrees of freedom. The polaritons are essentially part of a spin. These are bosonic degrees of freedom. In 1D, we always have Jordan-Wigner. So we can fermionize them by strong interactions. But in 2D, this will always be bosonic particles.
Oh, you didn't discuss 1D here. So it was all 2D.
Oh, no. Okay.
In 1D, can you move into this, basically, into this regime? Where
absolutely, absolutely.
You have this like Fermi gas or this thing?
Yes. Let me go to the branch. Here. So that's okay, that's for the experts in 1D. So if you have a repulsive interaction in 1D, the scattering length is negative. So that means for very weak repulsive interactions, you get R down here. That is just what you will call a weakly interacting BC. Then you increase the interaction, then the scattering length gets zero. That's the point where you become non-interacting fermions, where you get the Tong-Shirado gas. Once you increase the interaction further, because it's a finite range potential, you go into the regions where you get repulsive fermions. And that is indicated by now by the positive scattering length. So yes, if you probe along here, so this is just the normal Lieb-Linegar model with a track with repulsive interaction. This is the Lieb-Linegar model where, to describe it, you have to induce the bound state in your system. But here, there is no bound state at all. So it's this artificial model where Lieb-Linegar requires a virtual bound state, which gives problems by Bethe Ansatz, but you know that there is this Super-Tong-Shirado regime where people say that let's look at the lowest energy state, which is not a bound, which doesn't include any bound states, and that is the exactly solvable point described here. And the physics cannot decay into a bound state because it's always repulsive, yes?
So